Okay, so here we have a typical page of Gemara from the Vilna Shas. So, of course, as you know, in the middle of the middle text is Gemara, on the right is the Rashi, and the inner margin is the Rashi, and the outer margin is the Tosfos. So Rashi, of course, was the primary French commentary on Shas. He didn't write on all of Shas. We have several Masechtos, Nazir, Nedarim, most of Basra, which don't have Rashi on them. And usually there are commentaries on them which are usually written by either Rashi's grandchildren or great-grandchildren or other Baalei Tosfos, which Basra, the most famous example, there's the Rashbam, mm-hmm. which is Rashi's grandson, and there are others as well. On the outer margin, you have Tosfos. Now, Tosfos seems somewhat monolithic, but it's actually very different. There are lots of different editions of Tosfos. That's why some degree of Iyun learning in depth, has to do with comparing various different versions of Tosfos. One of the classic versions of Tosfos, which is out off the page, is Tosfos HaRosh, which is the Rosh, we'll come to him later on, the Rosh's version of Tosfos. And then there's most of our Mishnah Tosfos are Tosfos Tuch. Tuch was the town in France, I don't remember exactly how you say it in French, where base Medrash, this Tosfos was compiled, but there are other Tosfos. There's Tosfos Rashmi Shant, Tosfos Rabbeinu Peret. There are a lot of similarities between them because it was the same discussions which was being recorded in each person's notebook as he got the Mesorah, the transmission from the previous generation, as he heard the discussions, but there are variations. And that's what a lot of times you can pick up on those variations and see whether they agree with each other, disagree with each other. So that's why we have a lot of compilations of Tosfos which are beyond the Tosfos on the page. That's why also we can't ask a contradiction from Tosfos in one Masechta to Tosfos in another Masechta, because it's entirely possible that the two Tosfos are written by two different people, right? So therefore, came from two different traditions. So therefore, you can't ask from one or the other. Yeah?
Do we know who put Tosfos together and how the whole thing evolved?
There are a bunch of people. Here's Rabbi Lezer from Garmaiza, Rabbeinu Peretz, the Rash Mishant, I forget who did Tosfos Tuch. But we do know, yeah.
About what
year is it? These are all in mid-1200s. This is what happened, okay? Rash died in 1135. And the period of the Baalei Tosfos goes on until the mid-1200s. Okay, so it's like 100 years or so.
So the Baalei Tosfos was an era of about 200 years?
No, about 150.
150
maximum, yeah.
So some was put in and some was taken out. Like, it wasn't all put in, obviously, right? I mean, it wasn't...
Well, the bulk of it was put in. The bulk of the discussions, obviously, but you have places where there are no discussions, places where there are some live discussions which are off the page, yes. So you have different variations. Okay, now, on the side of the Gemara, you have here, in this Masechta, Rabbeinu Chananel. In other Masechtas, you have Rabbeinu Gershom. In other Masechtas, you have the Tosfos Rid. Now, the earliest among them is Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel was one of the early Rishonim, who, if I recall correctly, lived in, I don't know, what should I say? Tunisia. He lived in Tunisia. Yeah. Okay, Northern Africa. He was, there was him, and at the same time, all similar time, Rabbeinu Gershom. Now, Rabbeinu Gershom is very famous for his Chenon Rabbeinu Gershom. The Chenon Rabbeinu Gershom is, there are several of them, actually. Most of them have to do with halachos, which are very arcane and obscure, having to do with taxation and representation in Jewish communities. Because the way Jewish communities were structured in the Middle Ages, they all had to pay a certain tax to the local authorities, and who had to pay the tax and who didn't have to pay the tax, and who could settle in the city, because there are always restrictions against Jews becoming too prominent, who could settle in the city, who couldn't settle in the city.
In Tunisia?
No, in Europe.
Okay.
I switched. I went to Rabbeinu Gershom.
Oh.
So Rabbeinu Gershom, I should have really finished Rabbeinu Chananel before Rabbeinu Gershom, I'm sorry. So he made all sorts, he and his, of course, the people who came after him made all sorts of haramim. Now, chayram means a takana, an edict, which is backed up by the threat of a person who not keeping it being put in chayram, means being excommunicated. So it's interesting how the we know the most two most famous Chachamim and Rabbeinu Gershom are not to marry more than one, three actually, not to marry more than one wife, not to divorce one's wife against her will, and also not to read other people's letters. Okay. Now the Sfaradim accepted only number three, right? The Ashkenazim accepted number one and number two as well. So these Chachamim and Rabbeinu Gershom became in a unique way, which was unparalleled since the end of the Talmudic era, and has been unparalleled since, became universally accepted by a large community in the Jewish nation. And obviously that's because the time was ripe for these Chachamim. They were obviously an essential component of progressing through history, and therefore they were universally accepted, and therefore they just universally binding. Yeah.
People would do it like a lot of the other ones too, because as in my basement in Israel, and they put a hole in the wall because it's a sealed wall.
No, that's right about Yehuda Chosid.
Ah,
not Rabbeinu Gershom.
Okay,
we'll come to him later on. So the Rabbeinu Gershom wrote a commentary on Shad. Now we have very little of it. Mostly have Baba Kamba Mitzir Baba Basa. Rabbeinu Chanana wrote a commentary on Shas. We have a lot of that. And those two in the Vilna Shas, they were found later on. They were published in manuscripts in the 1800s, even though they precede Rashi and Tosfos, were published in the margin. There's marginal notes, whether they're depending on the Sechta, different ones. And there are other Rishonim of that sort of brachos. For example, there's a Rabbeinu Nisimcha, and then there's another Rishon in other sections. I think I mentioned Tosfos Rid. But generally speaking, Rabbeinu Chanan and Rabbeinu Gershom were the earliest ones. In fact, one more thing. What?
When did they all live?
They died in the mid 1000s. So this is before Rashi.
They're okay,
before
Rashi.
And this is on everything they comment.
Yeah, but we don't have on their stuff and everything. So also, we don't know exactly, this is called Rabbeinu Gershom's commentary. Rabbeinu Gershom's commentary. We don't know how much was written by them, how much was written by their students, right? So, and these are called kuntresins, pamphlets. And Rashi was also called the kuntres, the pamphlets, right? Because they were issued as pamphlets. They weren't printed on the side of a Gemara yet, because there's no printing. So so these are pamphlets which circulated. And, of course, well, Rashi had access, I don't know if he had access to Rabbeinu Chanan, but he certainly had access to Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was not one of his teachers, because he died before he was born, but one of his teacher's teachers. And therefore, in the Batei Medrash where Rashi studied, these Kuntresim, Rabbeinu Gershom, and other earlier forerunners of Rashi were circulating, and he certainly relied upon them a great deal when he formulated his own commentary. Okay? Rashi did not write just from scratch. Now, as I mentioned before, we have here the Rashi, Tosfos, Rabbeinu Chananu, and then we have, or whatever it is, Rabbeinu Gershom, Mesechtos, and then we have here other commentaries on the page, which are all much later. Kirizu Achronim, where I go Sabach was 1500s. We're going from the 1200s to the 1500s. The Shastra B'Kiv Eger, that's 1800s. The Emisho Ner Mitzvah is also relatively, I think it's also 1800s. So the Bach is interesting. He's basically almost the last person who was given, who was recognized as being capable or being having a legitimate capacity to amend the actual text of the Talmud. Now that's a very important point. Anybody here read The Chosen ever?
Yeah.
Right? You read The Chosen? Nobody else read The Chosen?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Boy,
a long time ago.
These guys are ignoramuses. What's going on here? The Chosen is a basic Jewish book. Oh yeah? So didn't tell about the open.
Uh-huh.
So I read The Chosen for the first time when I was in fifth grade. It had the you're way beyond. So it has a very pernicious influence, because in The Chosen the heroes are the guys who amend the Talmud text. And the villains are the guys who refuse to amend Talmudic texts. And that actually is, part and parcel of the plot of the book. And even the subsequent is the next one? In the sequel. So the promise that even becomes more of an issue. So we actually side with the assumption that you can't amend the text anymore. That the text has been amended by the Rishonim to the greatest possible degree. And therefore, the Bach is considered to be like just about the last person who was able to amend the text. Now, the Gra does it occasionally too, and we trust the Vilna Gaon because he was the Vilna Gaon, but the Bach does it very frequently. Rabbi Akiva, who's on the page, usually asks questions or gives cross references. Vein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, which I think is actually quite late, was put with cross references to the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch. It's not really commentary; it's like an index. Okay, that's the page.
And the amendments. What were they actually amending?
They added words. They took out words which they felt was superfluous. Okay. So the text of Talmud doesn't have the same sanctity, obviously, as the Tanakh. So therefore, they felt they were justified in doing so, and it went on again, as I said, as late as the Bachum, even as late as the Vilna Gaon.
The Grib is much
later. It's usually just cross references. That's the Shai Berlin. He actually wrote the Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. It was, I think it was in the 17th or 18th century, but I'm not sure which one.
Who's the Gaon Yeshua from Boaz?
Well, I forgot what he wrote. He wrote one of the commentaries here. You're right. I don't remember which one. Okay, at the end of the Masechta, now we're progressing further, right? At the end of the Masechta, you have some Masechtas, you have Piskei Tosfos. Now, Piskei Tosfos are the halachic conclusions of Tosfos, which are extracted from the Tosfos by an anonymous author. We don't know who it was, but he's considered to be authoritative nonetheless. So therefore, if he says something, you're supposed to take it into account and say, well, this must be what Tosfos Prah meant. If I don't see it, I have to figure out why I don't see it.
Wait, what does that do?
It takes out lucky conclusions of the Tosfos and compiles them.
Wow.
Okay? After the Piskei Tosfos, the order varies slightly in this and Masechus, but generally it's more or less the same. You have Barush. Now, the Rosh was a student of the Maharami Wittenberg. The Maharami Wittenberg lived in the mid-1200s, late 1200s. He lived in Germany. The Maharami Wittenberg was one of the last Bali Tosfos. He's quoted in Tosfos one or two times. He is famous for having been taken into captivity and having refused to be ransomed, and having not only was not ransomed during his lifetime, but for many years after he died, he was not ransomed until finally one day they ransomed his body and buried him. But he said he did not want to be ransomed because the duke or whoever took him into prison wanted an exorbitant sum from the Jewish community in order to redeem him, and he did not want to set a precedent. Okay? So the Maharami Rutenberg's Talmud was the Rosh. And his student, and the Rosh, at the time the Maharami Rutenberg was taken to jail, he fled to Spain in order to avoid being taken captive. So this is the late 1200s, early 1300s. Okay? So what the Rosh actually is, although this is not necessarily well known, is that the Rosh is a commentary on the Rif. Now let's turn to the Rif in order to explain that. This is the Rif. It looks like the Gemara,
uh-huh.
Right? And very often people mistake it for being just a summary of the Gemara, which I always thought that it was when I was a youngster. But it's not. So the Rif did an earlier version of the Rosh, is the Rif, and the Rif was before, pre Maimonidean. Actually, he was the Rambam's father's Rebbe, and he lived, that means, in the, perhaps even the late 900s, no, 1000s. Let's see when he died. He arrived in Spain, it says, in 1088, so I guess he died in 1103. So he died, actually he was contemporaneous with Rashi, although Rashi never saw the Rif.
He
was the Rambam's Rebbe? He was the Rambam's father's Rebbe.
Rambam's father.
Rabbi Maimon's Rebbe. Okay. So he did this work, he extracted the halacha from the Gemara, and the Rosh is a commentary. In other words, even though it's now been published separately with its own commentaries on it, but initially it was meant to comment on the Rif and bring down, you know, agreements with the Rif, disagreements with the Rif. Very often you'll quote Rashi or the Tosfos, because he came after the period of the Tosfos in the late 1200s. Again, his Rebbe was one of the last Bali Tosfos, and he quotes them, and generally speaking, even though he lived his life in Spain, he quotes many sources from the Ashkenazic tradition. Now, because obviously he was born and came from Germany. In the Rosh itself, you have Hagoh Sashri. That's where it says Hagoh, Hagoh, etc., etc. Hagoh Sashri is also Rishon, I forget which period, I think 1300s. He quotes many more later Ashkenazi Rishonim. Now, with Ashkenazi Rishonim, generally speaking, among the period of Rishonim, Ashkenazim got second billing to the Sfaradim. This trend was only reversed in the period of the middle to late Achronim, right? So therefore, the Ashkenazim trying to keep hope alive, they tried, they compiled the records of their own discussions and rulings, and Zagosa Shri brings down some of these conclusions from the books of the Ashkenazic Rishonim, such as, it always usually says at the end what he brings it from. So he brings down, for example, on this page, he brings up from the Mariach, that's Rav Yehuda Chosid, and I think all of them this page are from the Rav Yehuda Chosid, and other sources as well.
The Rosh was the son of the Torah?
The Torah was the son of the Rosh.
The Torah was the son of the Rosh.
Yes. Actually, here, most of them from Yehuda Chosid. But he does bring down other sources as well. On the Rosh, there are various different commentaries which are written over the year. In different Masechtos, there are different ones. There's the Korban Asanel, there's the Madonna Yontif. So those appear at the bottom of the Rosh. And there's even a Bach on the Rosh, where the Bach makes his emendations for the Rosh as well. Okay?
Are these being studied?
Sorry?
Are these being studied? Like, you know, do people actually go into them a lot? Yeah.
Now, after the Rosh, we have the Perush HaMishnayos of the Rambam. Right? These are not, so obviously nothing here is chronologically in order. So the Rambam obviously wrote his commentary in Arabic. I don't know if that's obvious, actually, but he wrote his commentary in Arabic and was translated for the purpose of inclusion in the Gemara. Actually, it was translated during his lifetime by Rav Yehuda ibn Tibbon, and he wrote it when he was very young, in his 20s, but became nevertheless a standard commentary in the Mishnayos. And even though this is a Gemara, not a Mishnayos, nevertheless, the Rambam's commentary got printed inside the Gemara as well. There's a new translation, which was done in the 20th century by Yosef Kapach, a Yemenite scholar of many of the Rambam's writings, including his commentary in the Mishnayos, including the Moreh Nevuchim, and I think there must be a couple of other things as well. It's a big controversy who's more authoritative. Is even Tibbon, the early translator, more authoritative, or is Kapach more authoritative? Big controversy. So in any event, that's the Kapach is not in the Gemara, that's outside the Gemara, it's its own separate paper. The
That's ancient Hebrew? It's been translated from
Arabic? No, Kapach translated from the original Arabic.
No, but the Rambam, what
Hebrew,
that's today written in what?
This is
Hebrew.
Hebrew.
Yeah, it's medieval Hebrew. Yeah.
Rashi and Riff, the same thing?
Yeah, but they didn't see each other's commentaries.
Their commentaries were different, though.
Yeah.
Rashi is just giving, like, summarizing the Gushak of the Torah of the Gemara versus bringing down the Halacha.
Right.
Alright. So that's why Rashi gets to be on the page of the Gemara. Did anyone else do what Rashi did?
Well, before him did it. After him, you know, again, some of the Bali Tosfos did it, even on things which Rashi already wrote on, such as the 10th paragraph of Pesachim, there's a Rashbam besides the Rashi. But generally speaking, that type of commentary, Rashi's was so good, there was no need for a subsequent one except on stuff he didn't write on.
And the Riff was the first to do, like, codified halakha?
No, there was Gaonim who did this as well. The Bahaz, the Baal Ochus, was considered to be the first.
Uh-huh.
But he's considered more authoritative.
Yehuda Ibn Tibbon, what did he write with the famous work other than the commentary?
He was a famous translator. He translated other stuff as well.
But did he have any
original? I don't think he had any original. Maybe poetry and stuff, but I don't think he had nothing of major Talmudic import. Now, after the Rambam, in different sections, you have different orders, but here you have the Hamatargim. The Hamatargim is the translations of words in Rashi, or sometimes places, which are old French, right? And he translates them, he translates them into Hebrew and into Yiddish. They say he was a maskil. A maskil means like not a free thinker, but kind of like one of these, the late Lithuanian intelligentsia, which had more broad-minded approaches to things, so to speak, than the classic Talmudic scholars. But, so he was employed by the Vilna, the widow and brother's Rom printing press, which printed the this edition of the Talmud, and he actually wrote it, and it's anonymous.
He was looked down upon.
Well, nobody knows exactly who it was, but yeah, it was considered, assumed that he was not necessarily impeccably authoritative.
What
is it called? I'm talking the translator.
Is there a problem though that this is a translation like this?
No.
And he ended up in the Gemara anyway.
Sorry.
He ended up in the Gemara anyway.
The printers, they were not so frum.
Huh?
There was a misconception that Vilna was like a really frum city. The Vilna printers, the widow and brothers Rom, they printed, it's so funny to see, you know, they printed a lot of Sfarim. They printed Tanya, which is radical, print of Hasidic work in Vilna. And they're same, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? They're same idiosyncratic typeface. I don't know if that's the right word. You know, art school has its own typeface. Everything is art school type. So this is the Vilna typeface, right? Everything done in Vilnese. So the Vilna typeface, you find romantic novels and poetry written in Hebrew by the early Hebrew writers, same typeface. Like, you might think you're opening a Tanya to read that because it's the same size, same print, and same format. So that act, they were in it for the money. So they happened to make a tremendous effort to put out a fantastic shot. But they put out lots of other stuff as well.
What year did they put it in there?
It was over a span of like 50 years that the entire project took place. It's completed in the late 1800s. And as a matter of fact, there was they had a copyright on the shots. And in this First World War, there was some suspicion that the Vilna printing press had been wrecked. And there was an offset edition printed in Canada. And that after the war, there was a lawsuit against them, and it's very rare to actually find one of these volumes in the Canadian shots. It's very poorly printed. You can see it's like, I don't know exactly how their offset worked in those days, but they retained the rights to it, and right up to the Second World War, they kept on printing it. They also, in the 20s, did a version edition of the Yerushalmi, which did not become a standard, but they also did that. So they're very enterprising printers, but we think they only published the Gemara, right? So what do we know, right? So okay, they also published Mikron Kenos Chumash, and they also published all the secular stuff. Okay, the Hamatagin can come up randomly anywhere in the back of the Gemara. But generally speaking, the order of Rosh and then Rambam is always followed, and then followed also always by the Maharsha, Maharam, and Maharshal.
And that Maharam there is the Maharam
Lublin. Yeah.
And it was all kept, before they printed it, was all kept in manuscript form? How did they...
Yeah, some of these books were printed separately to begin with. It's interesting that just before World War II, the Rom printing press started printing Gemaras with the Rosh on the page, which would have revolutionized the way people learn. Because it would have made learning much more... the way we learn is influenced by what's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't learn so halachic because it's not on the page, right?
No.
And so we're able to comfortably divorce all our learning from the reality of halacha. But had the Rosh been printed on the page, then things might have changed.
What
did
the Maharal want?
What? Maharal wanted, right, to learn.
The Rosh?
Well, yeah, Maharal preferred the Rosh to the Tesis.
Wow.
Because the Rosh was halachic, Tesis was mostly pilpalistic.
Here we think he's all lost, you know.
He was very practical.
Why doesn't someone come across, like, Stanton? Didn't he try to print his own version of Talmud? I mean, did that just...
Yeah, but he wanted to print his own commentary.
Oh.
That was why he did it.
Feldman came out today with a Talmud with the Rosh and Rashi on the page, it would be...
Yeah, but Vilna took over... You don't understand what it said. The classic Vilna took over the market. You can't print the shots today, which is not in a Vilna format. People think this is holy. You know that? It has to look like that. Which is
did they make it like?
Which is it's absurd, but that's the way it happened. In the course of you know 100 years, this became the holy permanent format of the Shas.
Wait, did they make it? I mean, like the pages.
Yeah.
I guess
yeah.
The word Ella ends on this page on Lamed Daled Amud Beis, and Lamed Hey starts with Trey.
They did all that.
They did that.
Yeah. Cool. Oh no, the pagination, the pagination,
yeah.
No, the pagination comes from the first printing of the Talmud.
Which was one?
Italy in the 1500s. Actually, that was the famous
Santino,
real, the original Santino, but run by Bromberg, Daniel Bromberg, who was not Jewish. But printing Sfarim was a profitable business, so he printed the first Shas.
I think not
the
Jewish.
What?
Daniel
real Jewish
Bromberg?
Name, right?
I went
to check those things. So he printed the original Shas, the original Mishos Gedolos Chumash, right? Lots of stuff, because it was a profitable business to print Hebrew books. Jews bought books. So therefore he went into this and he hired the scholars who put together the original version, which had the Rashi, had the Tosfos, and had the pagination, which we have from then. That's why all Gemara starts from Daf Beis. You know that.
No,
I'm sorry, I keep forgetting what I really have to should speak about. All the way to start from that base of an Aleph, right?
Yeah.
And you saw me start from that Aleph from an Aleph. So why does the Bali start from days? Because in Italy, in 1500s, it was the title page was considered page one. So therefore, the first page
what?
Of text was considered page two.
But like
that would
give like rushes on
it.
I know.
All untrue.
Wait, what were the four lines at the top? What were the four lines?
Also untrue.
No!
So, oh, well, what you could say is that there are no coincidences.
Ah.
There are four lines on the top, because you have to read you four times. But,
oh, man. What a
shock. Pagination.
There is no Santa Claus.
Oh.
Yes.
What was the... But it's not... Why... Alright. But, like, it's not ushered to... Like, with Steinfeld, everyone, like, acts like he's a big apicurus because he, you know, mixed up the pages now, and now you can't tell what's one of the people that's on the ballot.
Right.
Because that's not... just so breaking with tradition, so that's not inherently...
What? Steinfeld was always considered to be a crutch. What are crutches?
Cockroach?
A crutch is when you break your leg, right?
Yeah.
And you need to walk around with crutches. That's what supports you, right?
For some
reason, though, article, I don't know why it was merited. It's probably because they're more pull and protects you. But they don't get the same bad rap
right.
As Steinfeld.
They're a bigger organization.
Bigger organization, right. Also, it is more scholarly. Steinfeld is much more popular than article.
More popular?
Yeah, it's not as scholarly.
Oh.
So
in 1500s or whatever, like the 1500s, did they take like all the manuscripts of Rashi and all that stuff and just chop them down and put them in the page one? Like in 1500s? Like what? Yeah? And the guys are like all totally like, have we? And all they were like pamphlets before? Like you had looked up all Rashi, it's all one huge long comment you want to do a friend? Whoa! See, like what? Like, to before they had to just.
Now they haven't had manuscripts, like everything else is a manuscript.
So they had all shots in their head, like they could just know what they're talking about and what line it was?
Well, maybe they had it at the top of the page, just so for the described wrote what it was on.
Wow.
I like your
what
reaction.
What was the name?
It makes it so much fun to say shit when I get this reaction.
What's
yeah.
The name of the
Ochadai,
which of this non-Jewish guy?
Bromberg. Daniel Bromberg.
When he
codified
it, they had manuscripts
up to
that. What was the first time they put it from memory into a manuscript form?
Immediately. They wrote notebooks. That's why they're called pamphlets, because they're all notebooks.
Yeah. Right, but even back to 500s, they had notebooks.
They always had notebooks. Even the Talmudic times had notebooks. But they weren't publicized.
And Quill, right?
Let me just read you a couple of things here. 1475, less than 35 years after the invention in Germany of movable type for printing, Rashi's commentary on Chumash was printed in Reggio di Calabria, Italy, on 10th Adar, and that's 1475, that's my birthday. It was the first Jewish book to be dated and printed. The Tur, which is the Rashi's son, was printed on 28th of Tammuz in Piove di Sacco in Italy. So I wonder if they actually have here the first time that the Shas was printed. That was in the early 1500s.
So what did the Vilna Shas do exactly?
Formatted.
What?
What's formatted, I mean? Sansino did that.
Right, they reset the type, and they did it in a particularly, and they brought in lots of other commentaries, and they combed everything for mistakes and fixed stuff up. So...
Wasn't a famous controversy with the Sansino press and with Romberg and... Two competing.
No, that was in the 1800s. That's between the Slavita Shas and the Vilna Shas.
Whoa, what?
Uh-huh. Does the current Sansino press today have any?
No,
Another question about the typesetting. Why did they pick that?
Let me just address this. The Slavita and Vilna Slavita publishers and Vilna publishers got into a big fight in the 1840s. It was when the Vilna Shas started coming out. So before the Vilna Shas was standardized, the main competitor was the Slavita Shas. Slavita was a deep, somewhere in the Ukraine, I think. And actually, it was a big competition, and lots of the government, and finally, the government got involved, and they arrested the printers of the Slavita Shas and sent them, and beat them, and sent them to Siberia because of some issue which arose. And anyway, Vilna won out. What?
The competition.
No, I think it was actually monetary, but, you know, monetary, I love it.
In Russia, in that time, in the time of 18th, early 90s, some of the secular Jews starting and even some religious start to involve the government into pushing off Tanya and Hasidim and whatever they don't like, they try to put government on them.
That's right. So that's what happened in this case. These actually—it was also a little bit of Hasidim against Misnagdim too, because the Vilna Shas was Misnagdim and the Slavita was Chabad Hasidim. So. Yeah, some things never change. So they, but it really didn't have to do with the Chabad for Misnagdim. That wasn't the. It would have been any Hasidim would have been subject to the same.
It wasn't just Chabad. It was
right.
Every other.
I don't see actually that he brings down in this timeline. I don't see that he brings down the Bromberg printing of the Shas, which is very surprising because you figure that would be such a major epic event that he would actually bring it down. But it's not. Doesn't seem to be here. They have when the Ein Yaakov was printed, but they don't have when the Shas was printed. It says here that the Mikros Gedolos was printed for the first time in 1516, but it doesn't say actually who did it. It doesn't bring down the Bromberg thing. Okay. Did somebody else have a question for which I didn't answer? Yeah.
Why did they format it particularly way you did with the Gemara Mill, the Rashi, and what's put on either side of it? I mean, it seemed a little bit more intuitive. You put the Gemara on the top of the page, Rashi in the middle, and what's put on the bottom.
I don't know exactly why they did that. I'm not sure why the commentary was written like that. I'm sure they you would think it would have something to do with being for some reason more economical, but I don't know exactly how it was.
It looks cool.
No, maybe there was a manuscript written like that, but I don't think we see a problem. A big problem is that we have very few manuscripts of the Shas. You know, in fact, we only have one full manuscript, which is not even full, in Munich, because, you know, St. Louis in 1242, or 1247, whatever it was, the guy who, from the town of St. Louis, was named, and who was the French king, he burnt these 24 cartloads of Sfarim, including many of the manuscripts of Shas, which were extant at the time. So we have very few manuscripts.
They have something in Buckingham Palace or something, some manuscript from one of the kings that he bought or something. I remember someone telling me that when I went to England, like they're saying like the things in Buckingham Palace. One of the
things about it, there's the Bodleian Library in Oxford. There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. High manuscripts there. Mm-hmm. But I said many of the manuscripts ended up in Oxford, in the Vatican. And in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, right?
Yeah.
So they're actually, those were the major places where manuscripts wound up. over the years.
And the Ram calls some of the stuff might be in Amsterdam somewhere too, they said, right? Because that was the last place that he was at, and they said he
was. The last place I was Akko in Israel.
Is Akko?
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But these are the libraries. Now, of course, the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York also has many manuscripts.
Right.
That's because I think I told you that Salman Schechter stole all the manuscripts from the Cairo Geniza.
Right.
Right. He took them to Cambridge, and then he took them with him, stole them from Cambridge, and took them to
America.
How
did he steal them from Cairo?
He came and he carried them away.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, the school for thievery. Okay, well, let's check.
What's the Marashah come to do?
Yes, so all these three commentaries on this page. I see we're going to have to go through this next week too. We're not going to finish tonight. But all these three commentaries on the page, the Marashah, which is on top, the Chochma Shlomo, which is the Shlomo Luria, the Marashah. Marshal the Shmuel Edels, Edeles, Edels. By the way, most Ashkenazi Jews are somehow or another related to the Marshal. A lot of bloodlines go back to the Marshal, and certainly to the Marshal. The Luria family is a very, very prolific family, and most Ashkenazi Jews are somehow descended from one or the other, or both. And
any relation to...
No, not related to Dari. Maybe distantly, but not close. And the Maharam was the Maharam of the Rav of Lublin. Marshal was Rav, I think, also in Lublin. I forget where he was the rabbi. Anyway, be that as it may, all these commentaries have similar purposes. The Maharshal does more emendations, but also commentaries on Rashi and Tosfos. Very few emendations, not really emending the Gemara, much more Rashi and Tosfos. The Maharshal argues a lot on the Maharshal. He doesn't like what the Maharshal did, and he gives his own interpretations as well, mostly again, and Rashi says it's usually not touching directly on the Gemara, primarily in order to explain what Tosfos means, what the intent of Tosfos is. And the Maharam does more on the Gemara, but also extensively on Rashi Tosfos, again, giving a shot in Rashi and Tosfos when you have a difficult passage, explaining it. So these are really the first major super commentaries, meaning commentaries on commentaries, right? They were written on the Rashi and Tosfos. With the exception being, in the Marashah, you have the interesting phenomenon of the Chidushi Agada. And whenever there's an Agada in Shas, in the text of the Marashah wrote, so he has here, besides the Chidushi Alachos, which are his commentaries on Rashi, Tosfos, sometimes Gemara itself, he has Chidushi Agada, denoted by Chet Aleph and smaller typeface. And these are usually the one itself. He actually comments on, explains Agadatos in the Gemara, right? The stories, the parables. And he is kind of like a watered-down version of the Maharal. Maharal is, in fact, either his grandfather-in-law or his great-uncle. We don't know exactly, but somehow he was related to the Maharal. What?
Wow. He's the Maharal. Wow. Okay.
All Jews were related. Everybody's related. It's just
related.
People don't think that. And people think that, well, but everybody, you know, almost every Ashkenazi Jew is definitely descended from Rashi.
Well,
no question about it. Probably most Sephardic Jews, too. What?
How is that?
Come on. Go back generations. How many grandparents do you have?
I understand. Four.
Right. But how many great-grandparents?
Eight.
By the time you get back to Rashi's generation, the number of grandparents you have is some wild exponent of the amount of people who lived on the globe at the time.
No, but the number of the Jews always was exterminated, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but there are lots of converts also, but besides that, that makes it even more likely that you come from Rashi. As long as Rashi has any descendants, you're probably among them. And we know Rashi had plenty of descendants.
Does it have to make sense?
Statistically, it's got to be that way.
No. How many isolated areas of the world?
But they weren't geographically. They moved all over the place, the Jews. We're the wandering people. Hello.
How many Jews were living at the time of Rashi?
Was that the family?
Extremely small amount. So you're probably Rashi's your grandparents 500 times over.
Wait, if you go back 3,000 years to
David HaMelech, whenever he lived.
Every Jew is the same thing
today. Wait, if that's wrong, why'd you put on a...
Come on, guys!
No, I have
to...
Not the male line.
Not male, not son after son after son. But it's of course.
Wait, if you say that's quite obvious, we have more people going back to King David. Is that fair?
I think it's more than 100 generations.
How many generations?
Well, it's 3,000 years.
So each generation by 20 years, 25 years.
Well, 30. I'll say 100. So that's 2 to the 100. Whatever, that's a big number.
No, that's too big of a number.
What's that number? Hello, sir, you're Russian. What's the 100? Yeah.
That's like, what do you want?
2 to 100,
that's over
this bit. You can't do that
bonus
on a watch.
No, but 2 to the 64th, you can't even do it on a... You can't even do on a... On a regular...
So how
you
don't
say to play with the chessboard, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Has it worked? There's 2 million people in the world at that time. I don't know. 5 million people.
Yeah, so they're all related.
But somehow you have 10 billion ancestors and there are only 5 million people. How does that work?
It goes back to 4 women at the time of Rocky. Something like that.
No, but...
There was four married Jews, something like that.
By the way, anybody tells you they're the descendant from King David, did you ever hear somebody say, I'm the descendant from King David?
Yeah, sure.
All time, right?
Yeah.
You know how they know that.
Because there's certain bloodlines.
Once you tap into a certain bloodline, then it's automatic. So what most people, how they do it, they trace themselves back to the Maharal. And the Maharal, we know, was tracing himself back to Rashi. And Rashi traces him, the legend has it, that he's traced back to King David. They don't know King David, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, right? And not only that, anybody who tells the descendant from King David is not descended from the male line of King David. Because Rashi only had daughters. So they're all descended from Rashi. It's the only way they know that. And if it's not cut off at many, many hundreds of other points along the way, and Rashi is cut off, everything is not from the male.
What about Kohanim?
What?
What about Kohanim?
Kohanim are very, are son after son after son, right?
Right, so that's what I'm saying. If a Kohanim tradition goes down, so why couldn't it be the same with, you know, King David?
That's the only way somebody traces back, though. The only way people trace back is through Rashi. Nobody has a lineage back to King David other than through Rashi.
So everyone, you know how people go, oh, this person looks Jewish, this person looks Jewish. So actually, most of us came from King David, who was a descendant of Ruth, so no one actually looks like an original Jew anyway.
He was also a redhead, by the way.
Right.
But if anybody ever tells you the descendants from King David, I'm telling you, the only way they can know that is through tracing. You have to take out a book on Jewish genealogy.
I know Rabbi, the Cohen, he says he can trace his lineage back to Eliezer Cohen.
You know, there is a family, and I don't know if they actually can do this, but they say... Rappaport. Somebody whose last name is Rappaport is a Cohen. They say that the Vilna Gaon, who was the firstborn, any Cohen he met, I don't believe the story is fully true, because it sounds crazy, but any Cohen he met, he used to redeem himself, because nobody wasn't sure whether this is a real Cohen or not, until he met the Chaim HaKohen Rappaport, one of the great rabbanim at the time, and Rappaport had some sort of way of proving ostensibly that they go straight back to
Rappaport. Rappaport's coming to play like in Italy, I think, early, maybe 13th, 14th century.
I'm sure the Lady Rappaport's too. It's a kind of an uncommon name. But the point is that You know, even that doesn't prove you're a Kohen. Because it could be that somewhere along the line, one of the Rappaports married a woman who was not worthy of being the mother of a Kohen. And that changes that, right? You know, there's a whole tribe in South and Southern Africa who are all Kohanim. But they're all pygmies or something. But their DNA, the DNA of Kohanim, because obviously some Kohen came down there, married Mrs. Pygmy, and had lots of pygmy children. Right?
There's a rabbi from, Kupchen, so it's Kupchen.
We're gonna go to
like the head with the tits on it.
I'm sure you've noticed there are many more Kohanim than there are Levim, right?
Yeah. So what's up with that?
Because obviously, if you're going to lie and say you're special, why stop it being a lady? So then you're going to make yourself into a Kohen for sure.
Without a doubt.
I'm a lady. I'm not.
You're a loser.
Whenever we watch Kohanim Pam, it's always like 5-1 Levine to Kohanim.
I don't know. I can't say. Usually there are many more Kohanim.
Many more
Kohanim.
I think many more
kind
of. If you go to the wall, you see how many Levine are going after the Kohanim, like to wash your hands, it's like Kohanim.
I
want to
know. No, there's
like
something. Svardim, there are no Svardim Levine. I don't know what happened.
What are you talking about? There's a whole family. Anyone with the last name Lavion is a Levy. All
right. Very few.
No, there's plenty.
Ah, you're naming one.
That's none.
You should have said very few.
No, wasn't it an island where all the Kohanim decided to go to live on an island from like Sephardi back home?
No, in Israel, they do Birkat Kohanim every day. And like at Shul, there's always more Levim than Kohanim. Whenever I'm at Sephardi Shul, I'm the only Levi. I'm standing there for like hours washing hands. Every other guy's a Kohen, but I'm the only Levi. They're always like, oh, we have a Levi today. There are no Sephardi Levim. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened.
Well, Ashkenazim, we've got plenty of them.
Anyway, that's why we don't assume that all Kohanim are legitimate Kohanim, because, you know, people might have made it up, people might think they're Kohen because the grandparents are Kohen, but really they're not, because there was some improper marriage along the way, there are all sorts of things which could have gone wrong. Okay? So how do we get on this conversation? Maral, okay, so the Marashah, right, because Marashah was descended from a grandson or whatever, so he actually, then we start talking about...
You started
it. Right, I know I started it. I take full blame for that. So, but this is an important thing to know.
It's
important to know that there are very few bloodlines and that's it. No, you can trace yourself, you can tap in almost to any one of them at some point along the way.
What's the big deal?
Who said there is? There is no big deal. No, you make big deal of Chassidim.
Yeah?
It's all Chassidim.
Right.
Yeah. It's all Chassidim who did that.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because there's so many of them, so they have to actually say, well, I'm Chasha because this is my father.
Well, there's definitely right if there's many of them. How can there be more of them?
What? No, but they don't want to be Rebbes. You don't want to be a Rebbe, do you?
You certainly
do. I want to be a Rebbe.
Well, you're Rebbe, you want to be Rebbe, you better start working on your Yichus now. Make up some good stuff. That's the central component of being a Rebbe nowadays, is having the right Yichus.
Right. Yeah. It's not like the whole mystery, I don't know where he came from.
I don't think that's true. I think we do know where he came from. We don't know where he learned, or whatever he learned.
He just like appeared somewhere.
No.
We don't know.
I think we do know his father's name and you know where he came from.
He was like on the radar for a while, but he was
in the Carpathian Mountains. He came from a family which is an undistinguished family then, but he at that time Yichud didn't count for as much as it does today.
Right.
So
No.
Okay, so this is the Marashah, the Maharam, the Chovashah and the Marashah, they all lived around the same time, late 1500s, early 1600s.
But it seems like you learned them all wrong.
I'm sorry, late 1500s. Yeah.
It seems like you learned them all wrong, and like we said, we learned them all a lot last year. And it seems like you didn't understand Tosafot at all, because we thought like there's so many questions on Maharam. We thought to ourselves last year like maybe we didn't understand.
Maharam's playing now about the Maharam on the Agadah, not the Maharam in his work We only have a couple of Masechtas, the Maharal on Rashi Tosfos. We do have the Maharal extensively on Agadatha.
Right.
And the Maharal is watered down Maharal. That's
right.
Really what it is.
Right.
And when he talks about Agadatha.
What do you mean watered down?
In other words, the Maharal is very esoteric, philosophical, and a lot of times he writes things like, you know, if you're really smart, you'll understand what I just said, and
right.
I'm really not telling you everything. But the Maharal tries to water it down and make it much more straightforward. There are commentaries on the Maharal, not so many, but there's the Grid, and there's the, like you mentioned before, and there's the Karnei Re'ein, and there are later Sfarim which take the Maharal out of the Gemara and have super commentaries on it. There are a lot of later commentaries on the Maharal, including to this very day, the Stifler's son wrote, you know, Chaim Kanievsky mm-hmm. wrote a commentary on the Maharal. So there are many super commentaries on the Maharal.
What are all these super commentaries? What are they adding? I mean, it seems like today, like in academia, you have like everyone picking like these little nuances.
That's what they do.
So it's just like
Sometimes Maharal and Tzarichin. I don't know what the answer this is. So then somebody else tries to pick up the give an answer. Or the Maharal will say, you know, it's not so simple, but somebody else will try to simplify it. You know, things like that. Or somebody, well, the earlier commentary says this Maharal can't be shot because it says this, and somebody will come and
do you ever learn these super commentaries?
Yeah, but now, see, when you're in yeshiva, well, when I was in yeshiva, I had access to many more Sfarim than I do now. Because now my library is basically what I have at home, and Orson Math doesn't have a very extensive, library. So, so it doesn't, right?
Well,
No, it's very strange. It's very strange because they do have Sfarim which are totally not appropriate for Baal Teshuva. They're very complex, but a very small selection of them. Anyway, so but yes, I used to look at these commentaries, and sometimes when I get a hold of them, I, you know, I still look at them.
I mean, like when they say, "The person goes through Shas," does that mean that?
Oh no, no. Shas goes through Shas means this.
Okay.
Yeah, this is not
it.
No.
So just
Gemara.
So what's Torah?
When I do Daf Yomi, I just do Gemara. I don't do Rashi and Tosfos.
Oh, no?
Unless I need to.
Uh-huh. And what's Torah
Kula? Torah Kula is Mishnah, Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, the primary Midrashim, with the Medrashei Agada and Medrashei Halacha, which are, and the Tosefta at the end of the Gemara, which we'll get to eventually.
Where are the greatest libraries today?
Jewish Theological Seminary.
Why you?
YU is not as good big as JTF. At the Hebrew University, and the Oxford and Vatican and St. Petersburg libraries.
My friend, Yeshiva doesn't have an extensive library.
No.
My friend told me Cornell hasn't. He went to Cornell. I said Cornell is really serious. Like,
yeah, a lot of colleges have serious Judaic libraries because they have lots of money, so they just buy stuff.
Yeah, they feel like you sit on 1,600 man, like all.
Yeah, people leave them.
They have a stack of Sfarim,
like
you take out from for like months.
Yeah, that's right. When I was in Hopkins, I took out Sfarim from their library. Oh, we also got to use them, so
right.
You know, keep them. Them. So most yeshivas have relatively small libraries. First of all, they can't afford manuscripts and other stuff like that. They can't, so they get the popular editions. Besides that, they usually have the stuff which relates directly to the study of Gemara.
Mm-hmm.
It's rare that you have a yeshiva which has like an extensive Chumash collection.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are some, but it's not in the near New Shulayim from when I was there 20 years ago. Very small, 25, whatever. They had a very small library. They had lots and lots of Gemaras, but relatively small, the other kind of stuff.
So like, the people are not so much in the know, or, you know, Yeshiva has been there for like a year or two, like, Mikras Gadol isn't really all you need, right, for Chumash stuff. I mean, like, you're not going to look at this thing now, right, huh?
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, if somebody wants to do more research, so they because most Yeshivas, you're not going to get very far.
When you say they have many different...
The religious Zionist Yeshivas have better libraries.
Which ones?
The religious Zionist ones.
What are the different translations?
Thousands? Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since you ever picked an obscure commentary?
When I was a little kid, funny you should mention that. When I was a little kid, when I was a 10th grader, so I had a Rebbe who suggested that some people have stamp collections, which I also had, and so you should have a Dvar Torah collection. So I went around for several years, just like 2 or 3 years, looking for as many, to write down Dvar Torah from as many possible obscure Sfarim as I could find. So I actually have a collection, still have my collection at home, of all these Dvar Torah, which I wrote, just copied, you know, those are good old days, I copied everything down by hand, from these obscure Sfarim. That actually was very, very beneficial because A, I got to learn how to write from looking at people's writing styles, and B, I also got to learn about obscure Sfarim.
Cool.
Can
you give an example
of
something that's very obscure?
No, there's so many of them. That's how, you know, there's so many obscure Sfarim, it's absurd to give. But I'll tell you, there's an interesting website. If you go to HebrewBooks.org, has anybody ever visited there?
No.
That's a repository of obscure Sfarim. Some of them are famous works, but there's so many obscure works on that site, mostly from obscure American rabbis of the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Hebrew Books?
HebrewBooks.org.
And it's in English?
You can look up the books in English, and some of the books are in English, but most of them are Hebrew works.
Yiddish.
Some are in Yiddish, mostly in Hebrew.
You find a lot of Yiddish ones.
Yeah. So there you'll find very exotic obscure things.
I know that in Vietnam, like, was all cute and there was one time
with
Swan.
What?
In Vietnam, like, was all Jews against the government, which expropriate originally. And
they return some, I don't know. Yeah, right. Basically, when the Russians, whenever the Russians took over some place, we transformed, so they sent them all to Leningrad. And that became a very major library.
Isn't it strange that all the fact that none of these four topics, institutions for Sfarim, are in any way like controlled by Orthodox Jews? Isn't that
maybe what I said?
See, the difference is Orthodox Jews in the sense of it. Orthodox, the Orthodox Jews learn. The non-Orthodox Jews are the academics. So if you're busy learning, you don't have that much time left to be an academic.
Well,
if you're not so busy learning, then you have all the time in the world to be an academic.
How can you be an academic without learning? Isn't that part and parcel?
No.
Huh?
No. You dabble here, you dabble there, you should get able to show off your knowledge. It's very easy to be an academic.
How do you understand?
What?
Why?
Because you don't actually have to know anything.
Where
you just have to sound smart.
You have to know how to tie a bow tie, and those are not easy.
There's a book which the Wall Street Journal reviewed on Friday, which just came out, which is How to Talk About a Book Without Having Read It. that's what an academic does. They talk about books without having, you know, all the academics believe the Zohar is fake, right?
Papers.
They don't even have ever read the Zohar. They just thought, of course, it's fake. Everybody says it's fake.
Hey there.
God has
two different
Bible, therefore there have to be multiple authors. Right. I actually did that in high school. We had to do a book report on a book called The Jungle. I never read it, but I got an A on the report.
Wow. One book?
Welcome to public school.
The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
You're a confederate.